What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Market moving insight and analysis. Join Jim Cramer, David Faber, and me, Carl Quintanilla, on the opening bell hour of CNBC Squawk on the Street. Good Tuesday morning. Welcome to Squawk on the Street. I'm Carl Quintanilla with David Faber, Mike Santoli. Cramer has the morning off. Dow futures holding some gains despite the 10-year, just 4 basis points away from 2%. Oil backing off. Some big news today at Peloton, Meta, earnings from Pfizer, Harley, DuPont. Our roadmap begins with Peloton struggles. Company slashing the outlook, replacing the CEO, cutting about 20% of the workforce.
Plus, it was the biggest chip deal in history, but it is no longer. NVIDIA's planned acquisition of Arm from SoftBank collapses due to significant regulatory challenges.
And Pfizer getting a boost from COVID vaccine sales, but revenue missing and shares falling ahead of the open.
We're going to start, though, with the shakeup at Peloton and John Foley stepping down as CEO. Basically, a wholesale reinvention of the board. Nine directors, four of which will be appointed in the last 3 years. They do guide on down on full-year revenue, looking for 3.7 to 3.8 billion streets at 4.2. And Foley on the call, Mike, saying he has made some missteps.
Yeah, I mean, really just the epitome of kind of boom-bust, moving fast to try and expand capacity into unprecedented demand, and then, you know, arguably having too much confidence that it was going to continue, right? That seems to be the short version of the story. And along the way, a lot of criticism about perhaps, you know, spending and management and all the rest of it. I think it was pretty, I don't know about clear, but I think that a lot of the news about who might buy the company and all that, I mean, I think that was sort of the atmospherics around things are a little worse than we thought. You know, now we have a company, what is it, $9 billion market cap, $10 billion?
Down from 50,
exactly. And, you know, you just don't know what the run rate is. And so it's an interesting shift. He also, you know, still controls voting.
He has 40% voting control.
Yeah.
And, you know, listen, somebody close to Foley this morning tells me this is not unexpected in the sense of he has been, take it for what it's worth, has been interested in or focused on potentially no longer being CEO. So that this is not necessarily, in their view, a sudden move in the sense of his long term was to step down and remain as or become executive chairman of the company. Although Barry McCarthy is taking over, we know fairly well, certainly I do, of course, having been the CFO of Spotify, had been at Netflix early in the gestation of that company as well. You know, unclear how long he will stay in this role. Haven't had a chance to speak to Mr. McCarthy. If you're out there, Barry, I'd love to. Certainly well regarded, no doubt about that. And there's still quite a few people who believe in the future of connected fitness. The question, as Mike sort of indicated, though, is what's the level of spending connected with the opportunity right now? This is a company that went from $1 billion in spend to $2 billion in a very, very rapid pace, adding employees at a rapid pace and infrastructure and logistics and so much in terms of the supply chain, because remember, it's not just software, it's a lot of hardware. And they're going to have to cut that back significantly. And they are in the midst, of course, of doing that. Doesn't seem like the kind of a company that would be sold at this point. That seems unlikely. I think we were sufficiently skeptical about that possibility yesterday. Doesn't mean that there might not be interest down the road, that if there was a huge premium deal to be done, that he might not at least take a look at it. But again, he controls the fate of that company, does Foley. By the way, he also spent plenty of money on himself, too. Not just not just increasing the company's capacity, but his own. You know, bought that $55 million house in the Hamptons. 3.5 million shares. You look at the proxy. And by the way, we don't know any, you know, 3.5 million shares have been pledged for personal indebtedness, right? Securing personal indebtedness. Goldman Sachs on the other side of that. But it's not like he didn't go a little bit crazy, too, in his own personal spending, enjoying what was apparently a short term enormous inflated value.
And a fair bit of outright sales of the stock, too. Right. About, you know, at prices above above 119, I think, or above $100 a share anyway, for the most part. With it. It's also one of these deals where you could have, if you handicapped it right, I'm not sure anybody traded it right. Because on the way up, it probably just obliterated anybody who was short on a valuation basis, short on the basis that the demand was going to go down. And now, you know, all the way down, if you felt like it was still going to be a company that lasted a while, it just gets wrung out and wrung out and wrung out. So the downside to revenue guidance accentuates the fact that we don't really know where it settles.
Yeah. Meantime, Blackswell Capital continues to call for a sale. A big slide deck online this morning, arguing for basically every legacy media company as a strategic acquirer. No longer developing this manufacturing facility in Ohio, which was announced last May. That's fairly large news. And then they still believe the tread category is bigger than the bike category. Here's what Foley did say on the call earlier.
But we also acknowledge that we have made missteps along the way. To meet market demand, we scaled our operations too rapidly, and we overinvested in certain areas of our business. We own this. I own this. And we are holding ourselves accountable. That starts today.
They will be looking for savings in the neighborhood of $800 million from these layoffs and the basically a reduction of expanded manufacturing. That's the question.
Go from a billion spending to 2 billion back down to a billion.
Yeah. But that also is probably why the idea of selling the company is not job one. If you're just coming in, I mean, you feel as if there's ways to rationalize the business and get it back in shape and figure out what the run rate. And, you know, I just feel like that's usually not the way it goes, that something goes from 50 billion to 10 and immediately the company wants to sell at 20. You know, that's usually,
it's a tough call.
So for now, it's about how does it get rehabbed along the way?
Yeah. A lot of peddling in their future.
Yes.
Yeah. Turn the resistance up.
That's. Let's get to a deal that didn't happen as well. It was one we've talked about a lot here, of course, and Jim and I have spoken about it oftentimes, but it is now official. NVIDIA is no longer buying ARM. SoftBank reported earnings this morning. We'll have more on the earnings, by the way, later in the program. But as for that deal, which would have been the largest chip deal of all time, it is officially now called off. We've talked often over the last year or more about expected opposition and what did come to fruition as opposition from regulators here in the United States, regulators in the UK, regulators in China. There was no shortage of potential opposition to this union. The only ones who seemed perhaps positive about the possibility of getting it done was NVIDIA's CFO, certainly, and CEO. But even they have admitted, and this was a few weeks ago, of course, already, that this wasn't going to happen. So they terminate the deal. There is a payment from NVIDIA to SoftBank, $1.25 billion breakup fee. And they will continue to have a relationship. NVIDIA will retain that 20-year license from ARM. Here's what Masayoshi's son had to say on the SoftBank earnings call. We are very much willing to do this transaction. We kept the passion for that. However, each government, regulatory, and those major players have been showing a strong position against or blocked the transaction. So that even with our despite our tremendous effort, we're terminating. Not much more needs to be said. They're going to try and take this thing public now. That is ARM. In 2023, and again in the presentation talking about it, as the largest, greatest chip IPO of all time. But we'll see if it gets to the public market, but that now is the plan for ARM.
Yeah. Is there a broader, you know, sense out there that SoftBank in general is, you know, by kind of design or by necessity a little bit in trim down mode, or they're looking to harvest some things? At this point, the stock, their own shares down by half.
Yeah, their shares have declined, as has, of course, the value of the holdings. Yeah. Although when you take a look at the Vision Fund's investments, they are still well above, obviously, what they paid for them. A lot of embedded value there. And again, we'll get to that. You know, unclear. I mean, there was a period where they got out, Mike, of operating businesses,
right,
obviously.
Sure.
Sprint and ARM was one of those that we viewed that way as well. They don't want to be operating things as much as they simply want to be focused on the investment side. And so this would be the only business they wholly own at this point, I believe, that they operate. Well, I might be wrong. I want to make sure the mobile business in Japan, of course, where all this began perhaps as well, but haven't kept up as closely as I need to. We're going to have more, though, on the SoftBank numbers and fill in some of those blanks as well.
Fair to say that this has been so tired in the making. It goes back to September 2020, and a lot of people had sort of begun to write this off in some ways.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, something I brought up, though, is you remember a number of years back, SoftBank owned a significant stake in NVIDIA, more than 5%, and then they sold it. And actually, you know, for an investor who likes to hang on for long periods of time, it was somewhat surprising. This deal would have brought them a significant stake in NVIDIA, made them one of the largest, if not the largest, shareholder in the company. And obviously, Masa certainly just wishes he'd hung on, because even with these recent declines in NVIDIA from, what, an $800-plus billion market value down into the 500s of late, nonetheless, it would have been a home run investment for him had he hung on. He did book a game,
right,
but not the game that was available if you go back from, let's call it, a five-year period. One of the greatest performers, of course, has.
I mean, not necessarily terrible. That, I mean, given what's happened to overall semiconductor valuation since they've struck this deal, it's not as if they're caught with an asset that's not going to have decent value in ARM,
right?
You know, when they eventually do take it public, if the market holds together.
And then the question of what it says right now about the framework of regulatory concerns, not just FTC, but all around the world in this case.
All around the world. China was always a question mark here. Now, for obvious reasons, because there was just questions about, you know, all of NVIDIA's competitors were not particularly enthused about the idea of them being able to take control here, given ARM's relationships across the board with so many of them. So this may have been unique, but when we talk about opposition potentially to deals, particularly in the U.S., we're talking about it because of this new regime in terms of both the DOJ and particularly the FTC, and you know, whether they're going to be opposed to deals outright simply on the basis of not even the law that exists, but what they believe is the market power of the acquiring company, and certainly that applies to the likes of Microsoft. Certainly Apple, even when we talk about a Peloton deal, if you think about it, or Amazon, just the size of these companies. And so it figures into every conversation right now. By the way, interestingly, practitioners in M&A, though, indicate to me there's still the possibility of some large deals this year. Companies willing to potentially take on that risk because they feel like they have the strategic need and it's imperative that they actually do a deal that still might fall into the crosshairs
right.
of regulators.
Well, that's why the Microsoft bid is
yeah.
so fascinating,
yes.
because they're willing to go through the hurdles.
They are.
There was even some discussion yesterday about Frontier and Spirit. Not because of the size of the
right.
deal, but because it's an industry so critical to the economy, got so much federal aid
sure.
in the depths of COVID and so
yeah.
forth.
And what it might mean for pricing on the low end. And all the airlines did rally yesterday,
yeah.
you know, in part on that news.
There's still some regret about what was the American deal years ago and allowing that the consolidation amongst the majors that took place. Perhaps it was one deal too many.
Right. When we come back, there's a ton of earnings news in the spotlight today, including a closer look at Pfizer. They do guide a bit light. Stock's going to go up and down about 4.5%. Rough start this morning. Take a look at futures. There's also DuPont. Harley got a downgrade of GM over at Morgan Stanley and Airbnb at BTIG. But Dow futures remain green. Don't go away.
Let's get straight to the point. You want to grow your portfolio to fight rising costs of inflation or pay off your debt or anything standing in the way of you and financial freedom, right? Yahoo Finance, our sponsor today, can help. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been helping great investors like you. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just looking for tips, Yahoo Finance makes it super easy by putting all the tools and data you need in one spot. Yahoo Finance takes a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and more. You can securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. That's how Yahoo Finance gives you insights and helps you take a look at your wealth in its entirety. That big picture perspective is what great investors need. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com.
Pfizer among the S&P 500's biggest decliners in the pre-market as guidance and revenue a miss overshadow a quarterly earnings beat. Meg Terrell joins us now with more of those details. Hi, Meg.
Hey, Mike, it really is the forecast that folks are focused on this morning that's driving the stock lower. As you mentioned, we did see that beat in the fourth quarter for earnings, slight miss on revenue, but quite light as you look at both the top and bottom line forecasts for 2022. And of course, a lot of folks focused on the non-COVID part of the business, as that is going to be just massive for 2022, the COVID part, that is. The vaccine projected to bring in $32 billion in revenue this year. The antiviral pill packs Paxlovid, $22 billion. That's the first forecast we've seen for that. And analysts are expecting, they say this morning, that to go even higher as Pfizer signs more deals. But of course, a lot of questions about the growth in the rest of the business and the future growth of the COVID business. The company's conference call starting at 10 a.m., they've already posted the slides of interest, the manufacturing ramp up for that antiviral pill, Paxlovid. It is really stacked in the second half of the year. 120 million treatment courses the company can make this year. 90 million of that is going to come in the second half of the year. And we could see them sign more deals around that. So that could drive up their revenue and earnings estimates for the year, which is an expectation we're hearing from analysts this morning. But of course, a lot of questions on the call, guys. Future of COVID business, what's happening to the growth below the COVID business, and M&A with all of that cash. Are they going to be big buyers in biotech? But the stock down now more than 4%. Guys.
Yeah, Megan, it's a fascinating setup. I mean, if you look over the last 2 years, Pfizer shares up almost 50%, whereas Merck, Glaxo, Bristol Myers, all basically flat over that period. So presumably most of that is the COVID-related businesses. What are the key factors or the key kind of new products or areas that are non-COVID for Pfizer that people are going to be looking for, you know, the longer-term story?
Yeah, so they've got a lot of things going on in rare diseases, a Duchenne muscular dystrophy treatment they're working on there. They're also working on different kinds of vaccines. They're continuing the mRNA partnership with BioNTech. They're taking it alone themselves, different therapeutic areas like shingles and flu. They also have a vaccine that's not mRNA in Lyme disease. They've got cancer drugs they're working on. It's a pretty big pipeline, but it's just totally overshadowed by the success that they've seen in COVID. It really has kind of vibes of Gilead and hepatitis C when they're just victims of their own success. And the street starts asking, well, how quickly is this going to decline, even as we're seeing these just massive historic numbers from the company?
Meanwhile, Meg, you mentioned the Paxlovid supply curve. We did get some additional data from Merck on their supply to the U.S. government. Again, as you said, later in the year. When do you think it's going to be something that is commonplace, where if you do test positive, it's really not a question, you're going to have those antivirals available?
Yeah, so it's a question both of the supply, and as we see that supply ramp up from Pfizer, 6 million courses available worldwide in the first quarter, an additional 24 million coming in the second quarter. So you're going to start to see that ramp a lot toward the middle and the end of this year. But the other question is, who can get these pills? Because right now they're only indicated for people at high risk because that's what the trials showed the benefits in. We need more data than to see that extended to everyone. But one more note that Pfizer put out this morning in its slides is that it's testing a next generation antiviral as well. So it's going to be continuing this. It's also testing it in kids. So we could see this expand.
Yeah, seems like the second half, certainly there'll be a lot more available. Meg, on M&A, which you mentioned, I mean, you know, again, this idea of redeploying the profits from COVID, essentially, COVID therapies at Pfizer into other areas. I mean, they did that arena deal last year. Expectation, I would assume, is there may be more to come in that same sort of area.
Absolutely. And certainly among biotech investors who've just been beaten down, if you look at the valuations of the IBB and the XBI ETFs, they are really hurting. So biotech investors are hoping that companies like Pfizer, and Pfizer in particular, given its COVID revenues, are going to be big buyers. The question is, do they continue the deals like those that you mentioned, or do they do something bigger? There has been a question, would they buy something very large? And we'll have Albert Bourla on, as we're showing now, in the 1 p.m. hour, the CEO of Pfizer, to ask him all these questions.
Can't wait for that, Meg. Good stuff as always. Our Meg Terrell covering all things Pfizer this morning. We'll take a break here. By the way, as Meg mentioned, she'll talk to Albert Bourla later on this morning or this afternoon. 10-year continues to be in focus. Yield 196. We do get oil some relief today as there's more discussion about the pressure on producers maybe not to grow, easing up a bit. We're back in a minute.
The market doesn't joke around, so why would you? Get serious. Choose Tastytrade. Tastytrade gives you the tools you need to make smarter moves. Dig into data with advanced charting, track profit accurately with order chain trackers, see risk clearly with curve analysis, and trade with low-capped commissions, stocks, options, futures, and more. All on one platform. No wonder serious traders choose Tastytrade. Join the club, genius. Tasty Trading is a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC.
If a friend asks how you're doing, and you say,
I'm okay.
When the truth is,
I don't want my problems to burden anyone.
Or you say,
hang it in there.
Because
if I ask for help, they'll just think I'm weak.
Then this is your sign to call, text, or chat. 988 for free, confidential support. Anytime. You don't have to hide how you feel.
Take a look at some leaders on the NASDAQ 100 this morning. Peloton's going to make the list, up almost 3% after all of these corporate changes and management changes. JP Morgan does maintain its target of $50. We're going to get the opening bell meantime in about 7 minutes.
Our roster of instructors is foundational to the Peloton user experience, and we will continue to invest in our content creators for the benefit of our growing member base. We will also continue to invest in our platforms through innovative hardware, software, and content experiences, improving our offering for both current and prospective members.
That's Peloton's John Foley on the call this morning as the street reacts to their news about management changes and cutting a bunch of investments. The street's general take is incremental positive. Key keeps a $60 target, reminds us once again they still trade cheaper than the Internet e-commerce group.
That's for sure. Obviously not directly comparable. I think that the takeaway I have is it's holding yesterday's bounce. Yesterday's bounce took the stock from down 85% to down 80%. Probably the majority of the known bad news is out there with the pre-announcement and the earnings today. And so you have a maybe increased optionality in terms of how they might improve operations or rethink things going ahead under a new CEO. And that seems to be the closest you're going to get. But I don't know about where 60 comes from unless you want to give it really much more of an e-commerce type multiple.
One of the, I think, standout quotes in the journal piece in which they do interview Barry was the company got over its skis in the COVID era, believing that this was the new normal.
Yeah.
And I wonder what the universe is of companies who kind of got into that same trap.
Sure. I'm sure there's plenty of them. The difference being most of them just, hired a lot more software engineers and maybe amped up marketing spend because they were a virtual business, as opposed to we bought factories. We're trying to retool to get the domestic production up. We're controlling our own delivery logistics. I mean,
so
all that
the
stuff.
Vertical risk.
It's just the fact that it's physical, it's vertical, it's fixed cost. I think that was probably the main difference.
Yeah, some of the notes point out that the Ohio facility in particular, they broke ground 6 months ago.
That's spent, $400 million, yeah, right? Something like that? Listen, but again, there are any number of these names that we follow so closely. Zoom, of course, comes to mind as well. I mean, the 52-week high in that stock is $451, yeah. Mike, and the low, well, not far from where we are right now. The low is 134, and you got a stock at 141.
And at the high, you had to really have this very expansive view of what that product set was going to be and how integral and how subscription growth was going to go. And now it's much more about maybe it is what it is, and we'll see what a normal pace of growth over a cycle might be.
Well, it also may be facing future competition from Meta.
That's right.
Exactly. And the metaverse and what that's going to mean for the enterprise and our ability to work together, but at home.
Yep. Yeah. By the way, Meta, as David said, extending its losses, now down 30%. Yesterday's action not particularly good after reporting last week. Meantime, NVIDIA has now leapfrogged Meta into seventh place in terms of market valuation. A lot of discussion about Peter Thiel's decision to leave the board after the annual meeting. Of course, Thiel was the first significant outside investor in then Facebook. 2004, he put $500,000 in. Hard to separate his motive to get into politics more actively versus maybe some argue not believing in the future growth prospects.
It's tough to make the read through, to be honest with you, about what it means for the business, except that they're in a new phase, they're hunkered down, he may have other priorities, and it's tough. But the fact that the stock keeps going down does show you it is not past that kind of give up liquidation phase.
Let's get the opening bell here at the CNBC Real-Time Exchange. At the big board, it's the NAACP and the Impact Shares ETF celebrating Black History Month. At the NASDAQ, Black Women on Boards, an organization celebrating 50 years of Black women serving on public boards. So some of the other names we haven't yet gotten to. DuPont, again, this sort of habit of guiding below on EPS on just essentially margin headwinds is becoming more and more common this earnings season.
It has. And I think that, you know, it's to some degree expected. Most of the stocks are down a fair bit when they're doing this. So it's not as if, you know, people assume they were going to be able to magically preserve margins. And the stock has actually opened up, you know, 3.5% on that news. So, you know, that's the give and take of how much is already, you know, kind of priced in there as the, you know, the overall market dealing with, you know, that kind of margin squeeze at the same time, you know, yields keep flying globally and we're trying to figure out what that's going to mean in terms of where we are in the economic cycle and what the Fed's going to have to do here.
He said, as banks lead at the open.
Yeah, banks fully capturing. In fact, today in the Treasury curve, it's actually a bit of a steepening action. So you have longer term yields up more. The 2-year is still up higher. It's obviously the stock market sitting back, waiting for Thursday's CPI number to see if that's going to push the argument in one direction or another on perhaps a half point increase in March. The market implied probabilities of that are getting up there. They're up around 40% to the point where after the CPI number, the thinking is the Fed either has to endorse the idea of 50 or really talk it down, because you don't want to go into a meeting where it's kind of a 40-60 proposition on what you're going to do. So that's probably what we have ahead of us in one direction or the other as the market price is in 5 plus for the Fed this year.
195, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And in Europe, you know, they're back to 2019 level yields, mm-hmm. which are super low, but they're above zero for the most part. And, you know, they got there in a hurry, I think is the, you know, is the real takeaway.
And to your point, the 2-year at 1.317, which we just saw. I mean, Mike, anything investors should be aware of as we move closer to 2, as you say, as things invert a bit?
I don't know that 2 is some kind of a barrier there, but
steeper.
What we do know is, you know, one of the restraints on where Treasuries went was global yields. So now that you have, you know, the anchor chains loosened on yields in Europe, and you got German yields, you know, above 0.2%. If you can get a 2% percentage point spread, you can have upside to it. I think the bigger question is what happens to corporate credit as yields in general go higher. It's starting to soften up. You're starting to see a lot of attention on how, you know, credit protection is getting more in demand, and spreads are widening out a little bit, but everyone says correctly from very low levels and not at anything that would be all that stress inducing if this was the, you know, kind of the going rate for corporate borrowing. But that's the area I think there's a lot of focus on.
Yeah,
probably rightly so.
JP Morgan note this morning says they have been fielding a lot of questions from equity investors on the move in investment grade CDS year to date. They do point out, though, it looks dramatic on a 1-year, not as dramatic on a 5-year. They say the current level implies about a 5% default rate.
Yes.
Compared to great financial crisis, you're talking double digits.
Oh, yeah. 5 is, and I guarantee 5 is well in excess of what anybody would actually predict. It's just telling you how much people are willing to pay for the downside protection. It's really a directional trade. You basically, people are saying, we think that credit has seen its best moment for the cycle, so it's probably going to widen out. Either we're hedging what we already own or, you know, but you know, people also say, you know, yields for global investors now in U.S. corporate debt look pretty good. So that could be also a little bit of, you know, something that slows down the rise in rates.
Oil is going to be one to watch. We mentioned we're back below 90 today. You got the prospect of better talks with Iran. There's this ongoing groupthink that maybe Russia wants to de-escalate situation in Ukraine. Nice piece today on Reuters about producers finally moving into high-cost shale as you've got prices so elevated. And then Citi last week said short December crude.
Yeah.
Out of consensus call, but they believe that maybe mid-60s by the second half.
It is interesting. Now, inflation expectations, if you look at how the market prices that, have really curled lower, and they've totally diverged from oil prices. Normally, they track pretty well. It's not clear which one's always right and leading and lagging. But you have had a little bit of a response in the oil price, which is super over. The energy stocks are all way, way, way overbought technically. And they're, I have great momentum. Long term, that's a good thing. Short term, usually you give back. I mean, I jokingly was saying that, when crude reached $90, there used to be this old rule of thumb in stocks. The stocks to get to 90 get to 100. It's not literally always true, but it seems like a strong tendency over history. So I'm not sure if the rule still applies to crude, but it is interesting to see a little bit of rethinking of whether this is a one-way trade right now.
Did notice, guys, and I don't have the note, but I did notice shares of GM are down sharply. Yeah. The rest of the group is also down. Ford, Tesla, Rivian, Lucid, which I look at as well. Rivian, in fact, down dramatically. But Jonas out with a note, I guess, this morning as well.
Yeah.
Not particularly positive.
No, I mean, the thrust of it is that we're getting near peak cycle for auto. So he's saying probably this year or into next year is when you're going to have peak demand, catch up in terms of production, pricing, all those things seem like they're peaking out. And therefore, when you look at GM and Ford trading 7-8 times earnings, that's because, cyclicals, when they trade cheap on peak earnings, that's not really the time to buy them. It also kind of backs away from the idea that you should value GM on a sum of the parts basis, meaning that the electric vehicle component of the company and all the rest of it can be separated out and therefore, given some kind of a higher sum of the parts valuation. And so that's a little bit of a rethinking of how you just go about it. But I do think the cyclical point is perhaps interesting. You could also apply it to the home builders. Home builders all trade 5-6 times earnings right now. Everything looks great in home building, but rates going up, it's unclear how much they can deliver. And that could be the call. If you really think that affordability is not going to be a problem in housing and you think that there's going to be more life in the auto production cycle and EVs are really going to, keep the kind of enthusiasm in the sector for a while, then that is your long thesis at this point, because they all look cheap and they look like they're telling you that the cycle's late.
Yeah. Jonas, not only goes to equal weight, but cuts his target. He was at 75 and goes to 55. Part of that is on the back of the guidance, but part of it, as you point out, is a change to his valuation methodology on the sum of the parts. The other big high-profile downgrade was BTIG going to neutral on Airbnb on, again, challenging comps coming out of COVID and sort of lumping it against other companies that have come off of double-digit revenue multiples. Just creates a dangerous setup in their view.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. Basically saying, the street's giving them too much credit for coming through it and for the stock too much credit for being able to hold that valuation. And the valuation is quite high, always has been with Airbnb. People just think you just buy it as this massive franchise value, which is going to be, gaining share perpetually. Stock down, a little over 1% right now. Of course, it is down 29% off its high. So it has recognized some of that danger. But the near-term booking trends, which interestingly suggests, again, a less dramatic Omicron effect, both on the negative side and on the reopening side, than we saw in a lot of the economy.
Also got to wonder if return to office really happens this time, and I know David is skeptical, do you get three-month Airbnb rentals in Montana, this summer?
100%. Yeah, and I'll tell you, firsthand experience as a sometime host, there's a lot of that. People don't feel like they have to, be anywhere in particular, and they'll take the place for weeks on end. So
yeah, it is back to actually having our what is now monthly debate about what return to office will really look like. I mean, we're coming up on the 2-year anniversary, of course, of all of us going to various parts unknown, and some of those people still haven't come back, which is just shocking. But as Omicron does go down, Carl, you raised the point. I love engaging on this. There is a new mindset now when it comes to what the expectations are for employees, and flexibility certainly is a key one. I hear rarely of companies that have an expectation of bringing their employees back 5 days a week. I think that has been sort of the
key. We are the only one.
We are the only ones. We're the only ones still wearing ties,
exactly.
Too.
Yeah.
You guys even wear them on Fridays. Yeah. But hey, there's something to be said for dinosaurs, as I always like to say.
Right.
They ruled the planet for 300 million years or maybe more. Guys, I did want to get to SoftBank. We'll do it as a favor report. Why not? It's a company we used to focus a lot on. Of course, don't forget the Vision Fund is still by far the largest provider of private capital out there when it comes to venture. The size of the fund itself is enormous. You can take a look, though, at SoftBank's stock price. That's recently. You go back a bit, not that pretty a picture. There's some of the holdings. We'll get to those in a moment. But when you take a look at SoftBank over time, of course, the stock has come down rather sharply as a result of the holdings in the Vision Fund, not to mention some of its other holdings outside of that as well. Why? Well, because of what's going on in China and a number of other things. That's a complicated chart there, but you can see some of the key holdings for the company, right? And what they mean to it, including, of course, what has been a great accretion of value with the Vision Fund. Even now, it is up dramatically from where it was, certainly in 2020. And for a period of time where it was gaining assets, they do have Vision Fund 2. I'd say it's early to say what's going on there. But things have come down since then. And you saw some of the names that we're talking about, whether it's DoorDash or Uber or Coupang or, you know, any number of other ones, or WeWork, which we know didn't go particularly well for quite some time, or other names. They've come down in value. Didi, of course, is another key one that has been dramatically hit as a result of actions by the Chinese government, in particular to that company. But again, when you take a look at SoftBank and what Masayoshi Son is saying, listen, he acknowledges the last 9 months, most of the high-tech company stock price were hit heavily. And after listing the companies invested by the Vision Fund and after divesting, well, their stock prices are negatively impacted by the market. So again, he says we're still in the middle of a winter storm. And the storm continues at this point. Obviously, also points to rising rates as one of the key considerations. It's a question we discuss here numerous times. Of course, this move up in rates, these high multiple stocks, particularly for companies that are in their key growth phase but not earning a lot of money. And that has been a key area where the Vision Fund has focused at this point. Its net asset value, though, $168 billion. That is down, but that's still up a great deal from what it was. So that's overall for the company. 49% of that is the Vision Fund. Question as well, what's going to happen to ARM? But take a look at VC funding, because I do talk about the private markets a lot. Hedge funds that have benefited from their private market investments, which have become such an important component of their overall. Two of the key ones there, not that chart, guys. Two of the key ones there are, there you go, are Tiger Global. Enormous. Look at that number. And D1, Dan Sundheim, they're down the list there. Then you got a lot of the other names that you might expect as well. But Vision Funds, SoftBank still dwarfs them all, investing another $36+ billion just in 2021. A lot of that going into some of those names that have not fared well, but certainly there's an expectation that will change. By the way, when it comes to ARM, they're also talking about what they view as significant growth there in the future for that company as they plan to now take it public next year. Just want to quickly look here. $2.5 billion in revenues they see at this point, $900 million in adjusted EBITDA, talking about a V-shaped recovery. They have increased the number of engineers, by the way, to over 5,200 at ARM, Mike, to sort of go into some of the questions you had earlier. But, you know, the Vision Fund is at least more than half at this point of SoftBank.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And so it goes is how it goes.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, so with Tiger Global, with those firms that really went aggressive in terms of venture funding, the story was they couldn't get you the money fast enough. I mean, that was the whole sales pitch, was that, you know, an idea, a meeting, a check.
What I wonder on some of these huge hedge funds that have significant private investments, how are they marking them? Are they marking them regularly? Do they only mark them at the time of a funding round?
That's a good question, yeah.
Because that
probably
will have an impact certainly on their own valuations. You heard Leslie Picker earlier talking about some of the tough times that certain hedge funds had during the course of January, but not clear to me that they're marking those private investments at this point based on their peers in the public markets, which obviously would seem to indicate that they should be down even further.
I would imagine at some point when it comes to calculating a performance fee, some client would say, let's get a mark on those things.
Yeah, you would.
I mean, I don't know how the structure is.
As opposed to paying yourself 20% of the ups on a mark that is just on a less funding round, which, by the way, you're a key part of. Because when
that's
you're Tiger or D1, you're a key part of the whole ecosystem.
You mark yourself up if you want to.
Yeah,
exactly. And also, of course, NVIDIA is barely down on this news, too. We should talk down like less than 0.5% at this point.
We didn't even mention Oscar nominations, finally. Netflix Power of the Dog leads with 12.
Yeah.
And Spielberg, incredibly, the first person to get Best Director nominations in six different decades.
Wow.
Unbelievable. So we're going to watch some media today as the Dow's up 91. Let's get to Bob Pisani. Hey, Bob.
They're going to be very exciting Oscar season right now. But with Dow's up 90 points right now. Amgen's got a nice run here. S&P is flat, though. Pfizer's weighing on the healthcare sector. Let's take a look at the sectors right now. People are watching that 10-year, folks. We're heading towards 2%. Banks are up on that. No surprise there. Industrials have been struggling because the earnings are tough for them. They've got price and cost issues. I'll talk about that in a minute. Tech's flat. Healthcare is getting weighed down by Pfizer. China had a wild session overnight. The 300, CSI 300, was sitting near a new low, bounced back a little bit, but it's been all over the place in the last couple of days. So let's review what's worrying the markets right now. Remember, the big concern here is basically stagflation. The worst case scenario is you get inflation and you get no growth. That's stagflation. So far, we're not. And that jobs report was very good for the idea that we got inflation, not good, but we still have growth. So inflation and growth is a lot better than inflation and no growth. That's one of the reasons that the market's been holding up so well. We are getting a lot of concerns, though, with that inflation story out there. And you can see that today with a lot of the earnings that we've seen, particularly in the big industrial names. Carrier is one that reported today. This is one of the big heating, ventilation, air conditioning companies in the world. And here's the good story. Look, the growth story is there. Revenue's up 12%. Organic sales up 11%. They cited continuing order momentum. All of the industrials have cited very good sales overall, very good demand. But they said productivity and price increases were only partly offsetting higher costs. And that's the problem, the margin pressures that you're seeing. As a result, a lot of the big global industrials are facing problems. They're getting their earnings estimates lowered a bit because it's not so easy to offset the higher costs with higher prices. So see some of these big names here in the last month or so that are down. Johnson Controls, Fastenal, Stanley, Black & Decker, all of them down 10, 12, 14, 16%. As you see there, just a simple summary of what's going on there. By the way, if you want to know more, the Carrier CEO is going to be on Squawk on the Street in the next hour. Carrier's down fractionally today, but overall, as I said, terrific earnings report. We'll get more on those productivity gains, price increases, and costs from Dave Gitlin, the Carrier CEO. Elsewhere, remember, we're about 61% of the way through earnings season. The trends are very clear. The revenues are great. We're going to have $3.5 trillion in revenues, a record high. The beats have been very modest, 6, 7, 8% versus 15% last year. This is more historically normal. And the big trend is just generally weaker guidance. The Q1 estimates have been slowly declining. This was a little bit common a few years ago, but hasn't been common in the last few years. And of course, it's because of the murky environment, including what the Fed's doing and including on price increases and the ability to offset the higher cost. Finally, a very curious note today, just on Grubhub, the former Grubhub, now called Just Eat. They're out of here. They announced that they're delisting from the NASDAQ. Now, the company, of course, Just Eat bought Grubhub, but their company is still going to trade in London and in Amsterdam. But this is kind of unusual, just a company to announce a delisting. And the reason they cited it was the cost savings, that there is an enormous cost in maintaining the compliance requirements for listings here in the U.S. As well as overseas. And I have seen this before. I've seen private companies even cite to me this is a problem for them going public because the compliance costs of being public, the legal costs are extremely high. This has been a bitter complaint for major corporations for many, many years. Compliance costs in the United States are really, really high. And here's a company that actually said, we don't think it's worth listing in the United States, Carl, considering the cost for us. That's a pretty big statement. Now, this is a $10 billion market cap. This is a small to mid-cap size company, but this is certainly potentially an issue going forward for many other companies here in the United States that have dual listings. Kind of an unusual situation there, Carl. Back to you.
All right, Bob. Thank you very much, Bob Pisani. Before we go to break, take a look at the bond report. Got the CPI coming on Thursday, and J.P. Morgan this morning does suggest maybe the market sits on its hands for a couple of days until that print. But for the time being, 2-year 1.32, 10-year just shy of 2%. The Dow has gone green for the month to date, although most of the gains here are Amgen. We're back in a moment. Market's in a bit of a small range this morning to open. Dow's up 82, S&P down just about 7. A reminder, by the way, you can always get in on the CNBC Investing Club with Jim Cramer. Sign up and find out more at cnbc.com/join the club. Or as always, just use the QR code on your screen. It takes you right there.
Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Neil Young once again taking aim at Spotify. He is urging the streaming services employees to leave the company in the wake of the Joe Rogan controversy. In a blog post, he calls out the CEO, saying, quote, to the workers at Spotify, I say, Daniel Ek is your big problem, not Joe Rogan. Ek pulls the strings. Get out of that place before it eats up your soul. Meantime, you have the former president, Trump, telling Joe Rogan himself not to apologize for some of these things. It really is morphing into something much larger than one or two episodes of a podcast.
It absolutely is. I think the real key is just what the deletions of the app look like. If there really is a groundswell of consumer response. Now, I know polls have said so many people intended to delete the app or stop using Spotify. It's unclear what the traction is. The market keeps acting like there's risk there. You know, the stock is down 14% this month. You know, we're only in the eighth of the month. So I think there's certain questions about, you know, pressure on the long-term business model at a time when they needed podcasts and proprietary content to really emerge from this this mess of free services that everybody has the same music.
Stock down as much because of those disappointing numbers. I mean, the sub the sub guidance in particular was below what any number of investors that follow the company had expected when they reported last week.
And then, of course, we're still on watch to see if a major music artist decides to also make it a cause célèbre of their own.
Right.
In the wake of the Rogan episodes. You've been listening to the opening bell on CNBC's Squawk on the Street.
Earning your degree online doesn't mean you have to go about it alone. At Capella University, we're here to support you when you're ready. From enrollment counselors who get to know you and your goals, to academic coaches who can help you form a plan to stay on track, we care about your success and are dedicated to helping you pursue your goals. Going back to school is a big step, but having support at every step of your academic journey can make a big difference. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.